Welcome to Radio Gorgeous, women's voices on culture, style, society and well-being. Radio Gorgeous, where women do the talking.
I am here with the best-selling author, Jane Green, with regards to your book, your latest book, Saving Grace, which, if I'm not mistaken, is your 17th novel.
Actually, it's my 16th.
It's your 16th
It's my 16th, which is still a pretty
impressive number. That's a big pile.
Yeah.
That's a big pile. That's a big pile. And you are also credited with co-founding the chick lit genre with Helen Fielding.
Yeah.
Gotta love that.
Yeah, really lucky, actually. I remember reading Nick Hornby's High Fidelity.
Mm-hmm. And that was the first book my husband gave me.
Oh, how romantic. Mm. Was it to sort of warn you of what he was like? Yeah.
Of English people.
So I'd read this book, and it was about kind of every single man that anyone had ever, known. And I thought, well, no one's doing this for women. Of course, I and all my girlfriends were dating the same awful single man. He just had different names. And I thought, I'm going to do this. Little did I know that Helen Fielding was sitting in her flat about a mile down the road writing Bridget Jones's Diary. That came out first and was such a huge success. So it just boded extraordinarily well for me and a couple of others of us who released books at the same time that were about single women in their 30s, and suddenly the press went, oh, well, this is a whole new genre. This is chick lit.
Mm. How do you feel about that term, chick lit? People feel differently about it.
Well, I think it was tremendously exciting at the beginning to be involved in creating, unwittingly, a new genre. I think, as with any label, it becomes quite oppressive after a while because you feel quite pigeonholed. And the truth is, it's almost 20 years later. I'm now writing about women of a very different age and dealing with very different problems. I'm writing about women, from their 40s, sometimes in their 60s. Sometimes I go younger, but the key, they're not romances. They're really about life issues. And I defy anybody to call me a chick these days. So I really do feel like I've left it behind. I just don't think it's what I do anymore.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You write books, novels about women and their lives.
I do. And I suppose if you were to call it anything, you would call it commercial women's fiction. Okay. I'm not writing the books that are going to be winning the next literary prizes. However, I also put a tremendous amount of work in, and they're very well written. I'm really proud of the work that I do and the books that I write. So they're just not. I think chick lit just denotes something that's sort of younger and fluffier and with an element of romance and designer shoes and handbags, and that's not what I'm doing.
Yes, you've moved on from that.
Yeah,
you've moved on from that. And as you have moved on in your own life.
Yeah.
So there you are. Let's talk about Saving Grace, your latest book. I don't want to give the plot away, so if you would introduce it.
So Saving Grace is the story of Ted and Grace Chapman. He is a best-selling author, slightly older. His career is on the wane. He's American, and he's married to this rather lovely English woman, Grace, who moved over to New York in her 20s to work for a publisher, which is how she met him. And they have what from the outside looks to be an idyllic life and a perfect marriage. They live on the banks of the Hudson River just outside of New York. And, of course, I'm very fascinated by the idea that we never know what goes on behind closed doors. So, of course, they look like they have the perfect marriage, but scratch the surface and all is definitely not what it seems. They end up taking on this new assistant, Beth, who is the Mary Poppins of the assistant world. She just is this force of nature who comes in and transforms their lives. But Grace has a feeling that Beth may not be what she seems. There's something that she doesn't trust. And I always think that one of the beauties of reaching this age, middle age, is that you finally have learned to trust your intuition. But in fact, so often I realise that your ego or needs or desires or ambitions get in the way, and you allow those to overtake that little voice that says, no, they're not good. They're not right. And Grace allows herself to be soothed and persuaded that that this Beth is fine, until, of course, everybody realizes that she's not, and it all goes horribly wrong. And there, and actually, Grace starts to feel like she's going completely mad, and ends up going to see a doctor on the advice of this assistant, really, and her husband, who's being now manipulated by the assistant, who tells her that, yes, in fact, she is going completely mad, and her life spirals into something that she never could have anticipated. So then the question becomes, how does Grace get her life back?
Mm-hmm. And I would say, you know, also for Grace, she's not exactly what she seems, because, like you said, her it looks great on the surface, and yet, you know, as you say, picked apart, it looks less perfect.
Yes, and it's what's interesting about this book for me is not that it has such an autobiographical bent, which is what I pull elements from my life all the time and drop them into my novels, and then, you know, let my imagination take over. What's really interesting about this is how much darker it is than my other novels. It's really, it's a suspense novel.
Yes, yes.
And it definitely is far more of a thriller than I have ever done. Mm. And has really a very propulsive quality. It's a page turner.
Yes,
in a
it
way
is.
That, you know, a lot of my older books are lovely, gentle character studies, like The Beach House. You know, it was wonderful. It was on Nantucket. It was fantastic houses, fantastic scenery, characters that you really related to. But the story didn't move in the way that this one does. And this
yes.
one, I know, I was very aware during the writing, and I work really closely with my editor. She wanted there to be cliffhangers all the way through. She actually now says to me during the writing of my books, Jane, things have to get bad, then they get worse, then they get much, much worse.
And it does. I would say that you followed that model
yes.
quite faithfully.
Yes.
And some of the things, it's, you know, what you touched upon is, yes, we're older and wiser, and we know we should listen to that voice that we call intuition, that we call our sixth sense. And because we call it names like that, we allow ourselves to ignore it, which I think is very common. And another common thing, I think, is when you're in middle age is to self-doubt anyway.
Mm.
You start, I don't know, because I definitely felt some of the experiences that Grace went through, as my friends and I starting to now call it the mental pause, as opposed to
yes.
the menopause,
yeah.
like they call
yeah.
it here. But, you know, physical characteristics, you know, not so much, maybe the 4 o'clock wake-up call, but the mental characteristics, which you're not used to.
Mm. Well, your hormones go...
Bye-bye estrogen.
It all goes through. Because this is actually what happens to Grace. You know, Grace feels like she's going mad because her hormones are so completely out of whack that she turns into somebody completely different to the person she has always been. And I, you know, here I am, you know, late 40s.
Same here.
And my girlfriend's all the same age. And we all actually are slightly amazed that we're still married.
Mm-hmm.
I really, really love my husband. I'm married for the second time. And second time around, I chose for all the right reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And I married somebody that I really, really love. And I honestly sometimes, I hear words coming out my mouth. And as they're coming out my mouth, I think, Jane, shut up. Stop. Why are you doing this? And I can't, it just...
And the compulsion.
And just the moods, you know. And it really isn't. It's thank God it passes. But I really understand why so many marriages do come apart in their 40s. I just did an event with this woman. I don't know whether she's known here. She's completely fantastic. So this woman called Sandra Singh Low, who just wrote a book called The Mad Woman in the Volvo. And it's the most hilarious book. And this book basically chronicles the year of her menopausal madness, during which time she went to Burning Man, which is this great big arts festival in California in the desert. And she went there with 11 of her menopausal girlfriends, and they sort of took off all their clothes and danced in the moonlight. And she embarked upon this ridiculous affair with this man. It was the year of craziness, and it was all menopausal madness. And I do think, you know, Grace absolutely goes through menopausal madness and Saving Grace. And sadly, yes, that I knew what I was writing about.
Follow us on Twitter, radio_gorgeous. Lots of love, darlings. Mwah.
Yeah, I mean, this sense of wanting to tear the house down.
Yeah. You just can't believe who you've become. You can't believe you've become this roaring... I really should always have been a novelist, because I romanticize everything in my life. Everything that I do, I think is going to be perfect and wonderful. But I am slightly amazed that I am not the benevolent, loving, calm earth mother that I always thought I would be. I was. When the kids were very little, I was like that. Now, you know...
Hell hath no fury.
Gosh, I mean, it's not unusual for me to walk into the kitchen and go, "Who left this book here? Get your coots out of here!" You know.
Yeah, and then be like, oh... I was telling myself just as I was walking down the stairs that I was going to be loving, that I was going to be... 2 seconds later. Another thing that was in the book that was quite strong was that, you know, despite Grace actually going through sort of hormonal and menopausal symptoms, was that she was considered bipolar and heavily medicated. So we're trying a different place, a different ambient sound.
So bipolar, I went through this, which is actually kind of stunning to me now, sitting here today. Mm. But as you know, obviously, Donna, the American mentality is very different to the British one.
Yep.
It's very much a mentality of looking outside yourself to either fix or blame. And not taking personal responsibility for things. It's why it's so litigious. And having lived there 14 years, I suppose I've started to absorb it slightly. And I was diagnosed with ADD, ADHD, mm-hmm. actually. And it was really because I was forgetting everything and I was very distracted and unfocused and also, you know, losing my temper a lot. And went to see someone. He said, yeah, this is what you have. So I was diagnosed with this thing, given the drugs that you take for this, which were really good in the beginning, but after a period of time became very speedy. I was very speedy. Stopped sleeping, was very manic, very edgy. Of course, my marriage was suffering because I was like this. So we decided to go and see another doctor, and we went off to see a therapist, actually. We mm-hmm. went for therapy. And he said after a while, Jane, you have bipolar disorder. And I said, I really don't think so, actually.
Right.
He said, you know, look at the signs. You're not sleeping. You're manic. You're talking 19 to the dozen, classic signs of mania. You're depressed. And I'm a psychiatrist, and I've been doing this a very long time, and I have never been wrong. And I remember saying, well, do you not think this is about the vast mm-hmm. amphetamines, you know, mm-hmm. the vast amount I've been taking? And he basically said, no, actually, and you need to be on a different medication. So he took me straight off and put me on these very heavy antipsychotics. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they removed all will for anything. And I just went to bed. And I went to bed for about a year and a half.
Oh, my God.
It was awful. When I finally woke up and just decided I can't actually do this anymore, I found someone else. He was horrified, took me off everything, but I didn't get better.
Wow.
And actually, all these other things started happening. I was depleted. I couldn't walk up the stairs. I was exhausted. And I had presumed that once I came off all that medication, I'd be fine. And I just wasn't. They started to find all these other things wrong with me, all these autoimmune problems. And eventually this guy said, Jane, the body doesn't break down like this unless there's something bigger going on. I want you to get tested for Lyme disease. Uh-huh. So I went off.
Interesting.
Got tested for Lyme disease. and that's what it was.
And it's so difficult to diagnose. We were just in the States, and my son got a tick bite and had the bullseye.
Oh!
And needless to say, we've had the... today I'm supposed to get results. We had the test before the antibiotics and now.
Right. And actually, I do think that you're very lucky, because they do say one of the things to look out for is the bullseye rash. And if you have it, treat it, you know, get treated immediately with antibiotics. You may want to think about doing antibiotics anyway.
Oh, we did them already.
Oh, okay, great. And that's the thing. And it's entirely curable if you do the antibiotics quickly.
Yeah.
If, like me, it goes for at least 2 years being untreated and misdiagnosed, then it becomes a disease that you manage.
I was going to say, there are so many people I know who are living with Lyme disease and undiagnosed for years, and literally had to have a knee replacement.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's horrible. It's so difficult to diagnose, because it looks like so many different other things.
Well, that's exactly it. It's very easy to misdiagnose Lyme, and people often end up not walking.
Yeah.
And in wheelchairs.
Yeah.
And so I was treated for a year, and happily, you know, it's now entirely manageable.
Unbelievable, though.
But, of course, as with everything in my life, when something big or dramatic or bad happens, well, what else am I going to do but put it in a novel?
Yeah. But that is so frightening, how things can ramp up. And on one hand, you say, oh, it's, you know, it's all in your head.
Yeah.
And then I think about, well, menopause symptoms. It's like, well, yes, but, you know, also, why is that just? Why is that a jest?
Yeah. And I did actually, I didn't use the Lyme disease in Saving Grace.
No.
But I did use the menopause as the excuse for why she suddenly seemed like a very different person.
Yeah.
And was then, you know, misdiagnosed with this bipolar disorder. Which, by the way, you know, really wouldn't happen in England. It just wouldn't ever happen.
No.
But shockingly, it is happening every day in America.
Yeah, that's really scary, super scary. One of the things I thought, I think a lot of us could see our friends and ourselves in these things, and also how one single event can sink your self-confidence and sort of sap. You know, the character Grace has Charity, and things go hugely wrong, and she just, in this hormonal thing and in this, you know, self-doubting and not listening to herself and just being, you know, sort of feeling, being manipulated. And she just, it just sinks her.
Yeah. And again, I think it's, you know, there are some days when we get in our cars and people can cut us off and honk at us, and we're just in a place where we go, whatever,
it's fine.
And there are other days when we get in our cars and everybody who does something, it becomes this huge problem. You get into road rage fights with people. And it's just, you know, it depends on the day. Just with Grace, it was just a bad day.
Just a really bad day.
Yeah.
Well, I now want to move on to something that in one of your books, Promises to Keep, you included recipes of yours. And I have heard you say that nobody invites you anywhere because between you and your husband, you have 6 kids.
Yes, it's true.
And nobody wants you anywhere.
It's true. And also, nobody cooks in America, which is really funny. I have this reputation for being a really spectacular cook, and I'm really not. I'm really a very, very average cook. But because I live in a town where the women only get either takeaways, or they go and buy prepared food, you know, the fact that I do cook from scratch every night is this huge deal. I really love cooking.
So should we go inside and get our coffee? And also it sounds like that stuff has stopped. So we'll just...
Radio Gorgeous, where women do the talking.
I really love cooking. And for me, cooking is less about the food and more about showing people that I love them. I really do. For me, cooking is love. Food is love. It's how I connect with the people I love. So I gather all of our friends in our kitchen and I feed them, and it makes me really happy. And yeah. I did actually go off to culinary school for a couple of months in New York.
Fun.
Yeah, it was fun. And I think it was there that I learned that I wasn't nearly as good a cook as I thought I was.
Yeah, with all the sauces and everything. Yeah, yeah. It's very complicated.
Well, it's very, that actually, you know, what you really need with cooking is patience. Mm. And I have, as my husband says, all of the patience of a fruit fly, which is none. So, in fact, even at culinary school, the chef used to shout at me every day, Jane, you need patience. And it's true. I just want everything done now. So I could never quite wait for those onions to caramelize properly. But I do love cooking. And I put recipes, as you said, in the love verb, which was promises to keep in America. They have different yes. titles, which is deeply, deeply irritating. and hopefully won't continue now because I've changed publishers. But I put recipes in that, and people seem to really like it. And I wouldn't do it with every book, and I wouldn't do it gratuitously. But I think in this, Grace is a chef. And so it seemed to make sense to include the recipes again. I also, because I have six children and cook for so many every night, I like recipes that are deceptively easy. Mm-hmm. So I never cook anything that's really complicated. I can, because that's what I've now learnt to do at cooking school. But I really don't. Once a year, perhaps for someone's birthday, I'll pull out all the stops and do a really fancy French meal. But mostly I cook food that's just very comforting and happy and easy. But you would never know how easy it was.
Well, I would, personally, because I have to tell you, last night, okay, well, you'll understand this with six kids. I only have the one, but my son's friend was over. And they got out of basketball at 4:30, and they had to be at Cubs, and we're all traveling by bike, at 6:45. So we go to my house, and they wanted to do a chemistry experiment. They wanted to make crystals. So we get on the bikes, we go to my house, get out the goggles and the safety stuff and the spirit burner, and we make the crystals. And then it's time to thankfully, a friend of mine's over. And we did Gordon's recipe first, because I had not known your recipe for Toad in the Hole prior.
Yeah.
So we do Gordon Ramsay's recipe first.
Oh, for Toad in the Hole.
For Toad in the Hole. We do his, because it's one pot, one pan. Okay, we do it. The kids get fed. We're on our bikes. We go back. Okay. Then come back and say, okay, now we're going to do Jane's.
Oh, I can't believe you pitted me against Gordon Ramsay.
I'm here to tell you, you won.
Really?
Yes.
Was my recipe better?
It was better.
What was better about it?
The batter was, sort of chewier, and it wasn't, you know, it had more give.
Mm.
Yeah,
and did you
really
do with when you made both of them? Did you pour the batter into a sizzling
yes.
hot pan?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know what to say. Really, I feel enormously honoured. I'm sure that's not true. I'm sure you did something
nope.
wrong with Gordon's.
Nope, I didn't. I've made it before. That's what I do. Mm. That's the one I've always done. However, I would highly recommend
a gravy.
His red onion gravy
yeah.
is out of this
yeah.
world.
I realised actually I should have put an onion gravy, because I always do. Mm. I do actually. I do an onion gravy with marmalade. I put marmalade
oh.
in my gravy, which is, I love a little bit of sweetness with
little
savory.
Sweetness, yes.
And I know you get the natural sweetness of the onions, but adding a little bit of marmalade to an onion gravy with Toad in the Hole is quite spectacular.
Yes, it's very good. Our guests who are visiting were very, very happy. Oh,
I'm
thank you.
So thrilled. Thank you.
So that was the fun experiment. But that leads me to, okay, six kids, cooking every night, weekends, house full with friends, and, you know, cooking classes. Obviously, there have been health issues. And still, an incredible discipline with your writing. Tell me about that.
Well, I love that you use that word discipline, because it is all about discipline. The greatest training I ever had was working on the Daily Express, where I worked for a couple of years writing women's features. I was on the woman's desk. And every day I had an editor standing over me saying, Jane, we need 1,000 words on this in an hour. And you can't say, well, I'm so sorry, I'm not inspired today. Try me again tomorrow. You have to write 1,000 words on whatever they tell you to write about, whether you know what you're going to write, whether you feel like you're writing or not. You have to do it because it's your job. And I do treat writing my books in exactly the same way. That's not to say that there aren't moments when it is unbelievably inspiring. And it is like something in a film. It is, the words flow through your fingertips and it's easy and you feel like you're watching a film in your mind and it's automatic. It's almost like auto-writing. There are still moments like that, and that's what makes it all worthwhile. Mm. But a lot of the time, it's not like that. A lot of the time, I'm sitting in front of a blank screen thinking, oh, I've got no idea what to write. I just don't know how to fill the page. I'm never going to be able to spin this into 100,000 words. I'm going to be done in 3 pages. And what I do, even when I think I've got nothing to say, is I write anyway. Because it's my job. And I set myself a daily quota of words, and I will not get up from my desk until those words are on the page. And that's how I've got 16 novels written.
Wow. And are there sometimes when that stuff is that you've written that day, that's crap, but then you deal with that in the editing?
That's exactly right. Annie Lamott wrote a book about writing, and she does talk about, you know, the first draft can be really bad. It really doesn't matter. It's just getting those words on the page. And I used to not do a lot of editing because I don't have any patience. So as soon as I wrote the end, that was
it.
I was done. And if I had to go back in and change a couple of lines, well, okay, I would. But now I'm working with a new editor who has taught me so much about editing. And I you know, with the accidental husband, she made me throw half the book away. And it was terrifying, terrifying. I really didn't want to have to get rid of 50,000 of my blood, sweat and tears. But I did, and the book became so much better and so much tighter as a result. And now I don't just do a rewrite. I go in and edit at least 4 or 5 times, and I hone and craft and tighten every single line.
Were you ready at that time to make that next step in your writing?
Yeah, I think so. I think I'd become quite disillusioned as well. I think I was a bit bored. I was just a bit bored. And what this editor has done for me in cracking the whip has made me fall in love with writing again. She's made me fall in love with the process. And I was never, you know, I was much more focused on, well, let me get to the end and what am I writing next or whatever it was. I didn't put that much focus on the process, the craft of writing. And now I do.
Wow.
And I think it shows. I there's no question in my mind I'm writing the best books today that I have ever written.
Wow. To me, that sounds, you know, sometimes like the arc of a marriage. You know, it's all easy when you're in your 20s and
yeah.
You're in love. And it's all, you know, oh, fine, fine, fine. And then sometimes you have to, you know, there's a maybe in midlife a stutter.
Well,
a re-romance.
I think that marriage is entirely cyclical. Actually, I'd love to read. Can I read from
Saving
Grace?
Yes, please.
Because I have a little meditation on marriage about
fantastic.
Grace and Ted, and I'd love to read it for you.
Yes.
Their lovemaking was never filled with huge passion. Tried and tested. Less passionate than well-worn, it had been satisfying, comfortable. Often it was quick, routine. Often they didn't kiss. It felt perfunctory. Grace acquiescing to fulfil her marital obligation. Ted initiating more because, it seemed to Grace, it was what he knew he was supposed to do, rather than because there existed a great passion between them. There had been desire in the beginning, but age, exhaustion, their busy lives made that seem a very long time ago. For years, it had been more duty than fun. For years, Grace had prayed for the sound of Ted snoring long before she reached the final page. How different it was from what she expected as a young woman, convinced marriage was the beginning of a fairy tale. All those years ago, she walked across a country field to an arbour strewn with flowers, her eyes sparkling with hope and love and daydreams. She had visions of a perfect life, of endless romance, of finally being able to breathe now that she'd found her life partner. There was nothing that had prepared her for real life, for real marriage, for the ups and downs, the times when you look at your spouse with something that feels very much like hatred, only for it to pass into numbness, then circle back around into deep connection and love.
I have to ask you, because as you are such a prodigious producer of things, what's next?
I have actually just finished the first draft of my 17th novel, which is provisionally titled Summer Secrets. And it's the story of, it's the story of a woman who discovers in her 20s that her father, who she always had a very troubled relationship with, after he dies, she finds out that he wasn't actually her father. And she has a whole other family that she knew nothing about. And she, you know, there are other things going on in her life. She's a drinker, a big drinker. And she goes to find her family. And it doesn't go as she expected. And when we meet her again, she's in her 40s and divorced and with a daughter and sober. And this is the time she's in a 12-step recovery program and she's working through her steps. And this is, she reaches the step where she has to make amends. And of course, last on her list, but most important, are her family, who she hasn't seen since her 20s. So she has to go back and find them again.
Thank you, Jane Green.
So welcome.
You have been such an accommodating joy and pleasure.
Oh, the pleasure was all mine, Donna. Thank you.
This has been a Radio Gorgeous production for RadioGorgeous.com. Get in contact with us. Contact us on info@RadioGorgeous.com. And to sign up for our shows to come once a week into your inbox. Who can think of anything better, darling? Love is enough, though.
life's filled with love. A love that carries all before. A passion in the flood. I lie beneath the rainbow. Now your tears have gone. And I'll sing my song for you. And I will carry on.
This has been a Radio Gorgeous production 2014, produced and presented by Donna Freed, edited by Bree Forer.